I think it's really neat that you have in this series of classes about the world of music, a way for people to get into this. Sylvie, perhaps you can start. Who are you thinking this is for?
Well, the proposal for those classes mentioned right away that this was for the family to take together. It's open to everyone who wants to take these classes. I would suggest perhaps more mature children, such as high school children, and their parents can listen to that together. Anybody who wants to just learn about those different topics can join. But it's really open to everyone interested in these topics in particular, or just as a way to experience a wide range of topics in within those 6 weeks or 7 weeks. And you change subject every 2 weeks. So that's wonderful. You kind of get a broad range of subjects and from the comfort of your couch. So it's really a great thing.
And is this something new for this online summer?
Oh, yes. Everything online this summer is new, except a few classes that were originally designed for online learning, and they were targeted to mostly collegiate students. But we had to turn around in about 2 weeks in April, 40 programs, courses, and workshops, or institutes, we call them when people come in person. But now they are called online workshops. So we had to craft them different ways so that people from all over could participate or audit. So we have a participation and auditor option for most of those online courses. But these particular courses are brand new in terms of the concept that these are kind of mini courses for all, and they're 2 weeks long, as I mentioned, and so you can get in, get out, and get what you need and the inspiration to go further after the class and to dig into those topics further, and you'll have the tools to do that and explore more on your own.
And how did you choose these topics? There's an interesting mix from beach music to symphonies to...
Yes. Well, these were proposed by the musicology department as a package. And they named those six options under the larger subject, whole wide world of music. I guess the WWW, if you want. Basically, it takes people to a travel, you know, with the pirates on their ship across the different seas. We're crossing the Atlantic to learn about British music and especially music that pertains to the royals and how contemporary composers try to basically, through their music, create this ambiance from different periods in the royalty. So, for instance, I watched The Crown, like many of us did, and that very haunting theme really sets us to the atmosphere of post World War Britain and the world of the time, which was changing tremendously. And so there's that haunting feeling and that sense that things are moving forward, yes, but not without trials. So this is just one example from that particular class. So people will have to take the class to know more for sure.
And if I could just jump in, the reason that the department proposed these specific topics is actually because we are all students of musicology, and these are our areas of expertise. Each of the other instructors, actually, myself aside, everybody else is actually writing a dissertation on the topic of the course. So anyone who signs up for these wide world of music courses is actually hearing from the expert on that precise topic.
This seems really wonderful, like having a friend who's an expert tell you about something.
Yes, yeah. That's the idea.
So Stephen, talk to me about symphonies. That's your area here. What defines one? What makes it special? It's certainly a word we hear a lot, symphony, whether it's the symphony orchestra or a piece called Symphony No. 5.
Yeah, so symphonies actually came out of overtures to operas. The word sinfonia actually just describes the fact that the whole orchestra was playing together to introduce the opera that would ensue. And eventually, these overtures became popular pieces to perform at public concerts. And you would use, even today, you can use an overture to open a concert. But as the popularity of sinfonia grew in public concerts, composers began writing specifically for the concert, completely detached from any opera. And then the works got bigger and longer, and became a sort of predictable multi-movement form. You'll have a sonata form in the first movement, an adagio in the second movement, a dance form like a minuet in the third movement, and then you could have another sonata or a rondo at the end. And so the goal of this course is really twofold: to describe those structures so that people are familiar with what to expect in a symphony and can actually follow along and engage with it as they would any form of writing or theater. And then the second goal is to give students a general idea of what kind of issues people are confronting in the symphony, what symphonies sounded like in the 18th and 19th centuries, and the sort of trends that composers were chasing, the different fads that went in and out of style, hopefully so that they find not only what they like, but also that they can engage with it on a deeper level than just accepting that it's beautiful music that they like to listen to.
And so there are orchestral pieces of all different sorts. I can hear an orchestra play. Well, I guess they have different names. Some are poetic names, but a lot of these have this name symphony. And you said it referred to a few different parts. Is there some sort of special knowledge to understand what's happening in a symphony? Or what do we get out of learning this a bit more? I think you alluded to it some.
Many composers thought of these symphonies as a piece of classic oratory. They used the five elements: invention, arrangement, elaboration, memory, and performance, and believed that these could manifest in a piece of music, even if it didn't have any text. So composers would often think of them as a sort of musical argument, and they would invite the audience to consider, evaluate, and respond to the oratory. Symphonic audiences were actually much noisier in the past, and they would voice their approval either with applause, shouts, jeers, that kind of thing, at any moment of the symphony that they either really liked or disliked. And it was strange to actually have an audience go quiet. And so I'm hoping through this course to engender not necessarily someone to breach modern audience etiquette, but to have that kind of discernment in mind as they're listening to the piece, to actively engage with it as a form of rhetoric, just thinking of melodies as musical arguments instead of just pretty tunes that we like to whistle.
And then I think the example you write about for our classical blog that we're going to share with people online is, I think, a very clear one for people to know. So I don't know if you want to walk through a little bit of that famed Beethoven's Fifth and its statements, or if there's another symphony that you just want to give maybe one or two examples.
Sure. I think Beethoven's Fifth Symphony is a great example because it's so well known, even in pop culture. So we get this moment at the beginning, this very famous opening where the whole orchestra together goes, ba-ba-ba-ba, ba-ba-ba-ba. And that is not only a great way to grab your attention, but it's actually the basis of the entire first movement. We get his first theme, all the way through that famous sustained violin note, bum, 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 ba. That is not only a melody, but it is a musical idea that he explores throughout the movement. He brings in a sort of, we can call it a counter argument, just a minute or two later with the horn going bum, 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 bum. And then the orchestra comes in with a beautiful, luscious melody, da, 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 dum, which is a sort of counter argument. It's a much lyrical, much more beautiful, lush sound than the earlier one that sounds so tense, almost like a heartbeat. And he puts these ideas in discussion. He puts them in dialogue and contrasts them with each other and bounces them off of each other to see what different kind of moods you can hear. And that happens in the middle section of the movement. We call it the development, to get very analytical with you, is when he has a sort of fantasy on these two different ideas. And then, much like a persuasive essay, the last part of the movement reviews the themes and sort of synthesizes them into a more coherent whole, the way that you might put a concluding paragraph on an essay. It gives you the whole argument one more time just to make sure that you understand the argument, again, from a musical perspective rather than a literal linguistic meaning perspective.
And then this starts, as you said, in the 18th century, and we have examples of Beethoven in the early 19th century that are very clear, but this is an idea that composers keep working with up until today. Does it become harder to sort of trace this out as we get, or is it still that same basic idea if we get to Tchaikovsky or John Corigliano or, I don't know, Adolphus Hale Stork and Joan Tower?
Yeah, so the symphonies that we're going to be talking about in the course are mostly in the 18th and 19th centuries. At the beginning of the 20th century, it did get kind of muddled. The meaning of a symphony completely changed, and people used very different structures, a lot of times crafting entirely new structures to challenge the very idea of what a symphony should be. But in the 18th century and the 19th century, you do see many of the same structures and ideas people are engaging with, especially in the 19th century. Part of the reason people were writing symphonies was because they were so deeply engaged in musical history and what they called classical music, even. That's where this name came from, celebrating music of the past. And so they were very closely entwined with what 18th century people thought a symphony should be, and the 19th century really developed it. At the same time, they did start messing with the structures. 18th century symphonies tend to have very clear structures. It was the Enlightenment, and they really believed in ideas of clarity, of structure. And so they wanted you to be able to understand exactly what was going on in a symphony. So when you hear, say, Haydn or Mozart symphonies, the structure is very clearly articulated. But into the 19th century, Romanticism takes over and people think of them much more dramatically, much more theatrically. And you might have a symphony like Berlioz's Symphonie Fantastique that, instead of being a piece of rhetoric, it's actually a kind of novel. Symphonie Fantastique in particular has been compared to French fantastic novels that were really popular at the time that it came out. And the structures keep getting stretched and made more grand, bigger, and more programmatic as the century progresses, until you get to the end of the 19th century with something like Mahler, who is putting songs into his symphonies. He's putting, you know, soloists literally singing music and arranging his own songs for voice and piano into symphonic forms. And his symphonies are also just massive. The orchestra is three times the size of what Mozart may have been working with. And the symphony itself could be an hour and a half or more just to sit there and listen to. It just gets bigger and the structure's a lot more vague because they're thinking of it in this sort of romantic theatrical style.
Well, and I think that points to it's really great to then have some of this basis to know where you're starting from when you start getting these bigger and wilder things.
Yeah, exactly. The whole aim of the course is to kind of hold someone's hand through this so that they have a basis to listen to music on their own. Exactly.
And so that's perhaps both Sylvie and Stephen. You can talk about this idea of music appreciation or these classes, perhaps whether what you hope to accomplish or also perhaps experiences you had when you were first getting into this music that sort of opened up this world for you.
Absolutely. I remember being in Quebec, we have a pre-college, 2 years of pre-college before you start your bachelor's degree. And during those 2 years, I listened to so much music that I had never heard. And it really opened up an amazing world for me. And so that's basically the hope, that through listening to an amazing array of music, people will find a passion that they didn't know they had, or they want to dig into those subjects a little further. We have so many different subjects through those mini courses that there's something for everyone. And if you're an adventurer of music, you can have a taste of everything through those 7 weeks and really come out of there with a new knowledge and a new ways of listening to music and learning about repertoire that you would not listen to in the first place, but that you're now exposed to and more aware of that way. So that's our hope, that it's a little taste of everything with a deeper knowledge for sure, with instructors like Stephen. You can't go wrong. You'll have a deeper knowledge, definitely, and develop new passions, hopefully.
Yeah, and I'd also just like to highlight what Sylvie was talking about, that this is very much about listening to music. A lot of music history courses or music theory courses will be very reading-based, very talking-based, very analytical or historical, but the goal of these courses is actually just to get people listening. I think of my course especially as a sort of yoga class or aerobics class where we're working on a skill, and I want to help you with that skill of listening much more than I want to talk about sort of dry details of chronology and things like that. I want the students to be able to leave the class and know how to use their ears and be able to identify sounds that they like and don't like and why. And I know my colleagues who are teaching the other courses are thinking much the same way. It's supposed to be very experiential and not just a sort of dry lecture-based academic course in the traditional sense.
Well, thank you both very much. It sounds really wonderful. And I especially think people are in for a treat with having great guide to the symphony with Stephen. Is there anything else you wanted to add before I let you go?
Well, I just wanted to thank you for this opportunity and also emphasize that I think this is really good for a lot of our WXXI listeners. I know we hear back from a lot of people about music that they like and don't like, and I would love to give them a chance to participate in this class, and hopefully it will make the WXXI experience that much more fulfilling.
And Sylvie, any last words while I got you?
Sure. Well, we have other classes. I'm just going to read the titles for people to whet their appetite. So, of course, there's Stephen's class, How to Listen to a Symphony. We have Sounding Royal, Listening to British Queens Across Media. We have How to Listen to a Pop Song. Dancing on the Sand, The Pleasures and Politics of Carolina Beach Music. We have swashbuckling sailors and the songs they sing, music and nautical culture in the 19th century. And then the last course is called Guitar Heroes, a history of the guitar and its music. And you don't have to be a guitarist to enroll for the class at all. It's for everyone.
Thank you both for taking the time.
Thank you, Mona.
Yeah, thank you.